confidence and hug them tight, trying to mask the urgency of our need just to touch them. It was hard to know what to say or not say to our girls about the shooting. Parents all around the country we knew were grappling with the same thing. Later that day, Barack held a press conference downstairs, trying to put together words that might add up to something like solace. He wiped away tears as news cameras clicked furiously around him, understanding that truly there was no solace to be had. The best he could do was to offer his resolve, something he assumed would also get taken up by citizens and lawmakers around the country to prevent more massacres by passing basic, sensible laws concerning how guns were sold. I watched him step forward, knowing that I myself wasn't ready. In nearly 4 years as First Lady, I had consoled often. I'd prayed with people whose homes had been shredded by a tornado in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Huge swaths of the town turned to matchsticks in an instant. I'd put my arms around men, women, and children who'd lost loved ones to war in Afghanistan, to an extremist who shot up an army base in Texas, and to violence on street corners near their own homes. In the previous 4 months, I'd paid visits to people who'd survived mass shootings at a movie theater in Colorado and inside a Sikh temple in Wisconsin. It was devastating every time. I tried always to bring the most calm and open part of myself to these meetings, to lend my own strength by being caring and present, sitting quietly on the riverbed of other people's pain. But 2 days after the shooting at Sandy Hook, when Barack traveled to Newtown to speak at a prayer vigil being held for the victims, I couldn't bring myself to join him. I was so shaken by it that I had no strength available to lend. I'd been First Lady for almost 4 years, and there had been too much killing already. Too many senseless, preventable deaths, and too little action. I wasn't sure what comfort I could ever give to someone whose 6-year-old had been gunned down at school. Instead, like a lot of parents, I clung to my children, my fear and love intertwined. It was nearly Christmas, and Sasha was among a group of local children selected to join the Moscow Ballet for 2 performances of The Nutcracker, both happening on the same day as the vigil in Newtown. Barack managed to slip into a back row and watch the dress rehearsal before leaving for Connecticut. I went to the evening show. The ballet was beautiful and otherworldly, as any recounting of that story ever is, with its prince in a moonlit forest and its swirling pageantry of sweets. Sasha played a mouse, dressed in a black leotard with fuzzy ears and a tail, performing her part while an ornate sleigh drifted through the swelling orchestral music and showers of glittering fake snow. My eyes never left her. My whole being was grateful for her. Sasha stood bright-eyed on stage, looking at first like she couldn't believe where she was, as if she found the whole scene dazzling and unreal, which of course it was. But she was young enough still that she could give herself over to it, at least for the moment, allowing herself to move through this heaven where nobody spoke and everyone danced, and a holiday was always just about to arrive. Bear with me here, because this doesn't necessarily get easier. It would be one thing if America were a simple place with a simple story, if I could narrate my part in it only through the lens of what was orderly and sweet, if there were no steps backward, and if every sadness, when it came, turned out at least to be redemptive in the end. But that's not America, and it's not me either. I'm not going to try to bend this into any kind of perfect shape. Barack's second term would prove to be easier in many ways than his first. We'd learned so much in 4 years, putting the right people into place around us, building systems that generally worked. We knew enough now to avoid some of the inefficiencies and small mistakes that had been made the first time around, beginning on Inauguration Day in January 2013, when I requested that the viewing stand for the parade be fully heated this time so our feet wouldn't freeze. In an attempt to conserve our energy, we hosted only 2 inaugural balls that night, as opposed to the 10 we'd gone to in 2009. We had 4 years still to go, and if I learned anything, it was to relax and try to pace myself. Sitting next to Barack at the parade after he'd renewed his vows to the country, I watched the flow of floats and the marching bands moving in and out of snappy formation, already able to savor more than I had our first time around. From my vantage point, I could barely make out the individual faces of the performers. There were thousands of them, each with his or her own story. Thousands of others had come to D.C. to perform in the many other events being held in the days leading up to the inauguration, and tens of thousands more had come to watch. Later, I'd wish almost frantically that I'd been able to catch sight of one person in particular, a willowy black girl wearing a sparkling gold headband and a blue majorette's uniform who'd come with the King College Prep marching band from the south side of Chicago to perform at some of the side events. I wanted to believe that I somehow would have had the occasion to see her inside the great wash of people flowing through the city over those days. Hydea Pendleton, a girl in a scent, 15 years old and having a big moment, having ridden a bus all the way to Washington with her bandmates. At home in Chicago, Hydea lived with her parents and her little brother, about 2 miles from our house on Greenwood Avenue. She was an honor student at school who liked to tell people she wanted to go to Harvard someday. She'd begun planning her sweet 16 birthday party. She loved Chinese food and cheeseburgers and going for ice cream with friends. I learned these things several weeks later at her funeral. 8 days after the inauguration, Hydea Pendleton was shot and killed in a public park in Chicago, not far from her school. She and a group of friends had been standing under a metal shelter next to a playground, waiting for a rainstorm to pass. They'd been mistaken for gang members, sprayed with bullets by an 18-year-old belonging to a different gang. Hydea had been hit in the back as she tried to run for cover. 2 of her friends were injured. All this at 2:20 on a Tuesday afternoon. I wished I'd seen her alive, if only to have a memory to share with her mom, now that the memories of her daughter were suddenly finite, things to be collected and hung on to. I went to Hydea's funeral because it felt like the right thing to do. I'd stayed back when Barack went to the Newtown Memorial, but now was my time to step up. My hope was that my presence would help turn the gaze toward the many innocent kids being gunned down in city streets almost every day, and that this, coupled with the horror of Newtown, would help prompt Americans to demand reasonable gun laws. Hydea Pendleton came from a close-knit working-class South Side family, much like my own. Put simply, I could have known her. I could have been her once, even. And had she taken a different route home from school that day, or even moved 6 inches left instead of 6 inches right when the gunfire started, she could have been me. I did everything I was supposed to, her mother told me when we met just before the funeral started, her brown eyes leaking tears. Cleopatra Cowley Pendleton was a warm woman with a soft voice and close-cropped hair who worked in customer service at a credit rating company. On the day of her daughter's funeral, she wore a giant pink flower pinned to her lapel. She and her husband Nathaniel had watched over Idea carefully, encouraging her to apply to King, a selective public high school, and making sure she had little time to be out on the streets, signing her up for volleyball, cheerleading, and a dance ministry at church. As my parents had once done for me, they'd made sacrifices so that she could be exposed to things outside her neighborhood. She was to have gone to Europe with a marching band that spring, and she'd apparently loved her visit to Washington. "It's so clean there, Mom," she reported to Cleopatra after returning. "I think I'm going to go into politics." Instead, Hydea Pendleton became one of three people who died in separate incidents of gun violence in Chicago on that one January day. She was the 36th person in Chicago killed in gun violence that year. And the year was at that point just 29 days old. It goes without saying that nearly all those victims were Black. For all her hopes and hard work, Hydea became a symbol of the wrong thing. Her funeral was filled with people, another broken community jammed into a church, this one working to handle the sight of a teenage girl in a casket lined with purple silk. Cleopatra stood up and spoke about her daughter. Hydea's friends stood up and told stories about her, each one punctuated by a larger feeling of outrage and helplessness. These were children, asking not just why, but why so often. There were powerful adults in the room that day, not only me, but the mayor of the city, the governor of the state, Jesse Jackson Sr., and Valerie Jarrett, among others, all of us packed into pews, left to reckon privately with our grief and guilt as the choir sang with such force that it shook the floor of the church. It was important to me to be more than a consoler. In my life, I'd heard plenty of empty words coming from important people, lip service paid during times of crisis with no action to follow. I was determined to be someone who told the truth, using my voice to lift up the voiceless when I could, and not to disappear on people in need. I understood that when I showed up somewhere, it appeared dramatic from the outside. A sudden and swift descending storm, kicked up by the motorcade, the agents, the aides, and the media with me at the center. We were there and then gone. I didn't like what this did to my interactions, the way my presence sometimes caused people to stammer or go silent, unsure of how to be themselves. It's why I often tried to introduce myself with a hug, to slow down the moment and shuck some of the pretense, landing us all in the flesh. I tried to build relationships with the people I met, especially those who didn't normally have access to the world I now inhabited. I wanted to share the brightness as I could. I invited Hydea Pendleton's parents to sit next to me at Barack's State of the Union speech a few days after the funeral, and then hosted the family at the White House for the Easter egg roll. Cleopatra, who became a vocal advocate for violence prevention, also returned a couple of times to attend different meetings on the issue. I made a point of writing letters to the girls from the Elizabeth Garrett Anderson School in London, who had so profoundly moved me, encouraging them to stay hopeful and keep working, despite their lack of privilege. In 2011, I'd taken a group of 37 girls from the school to visit the University of Oxford, bringing not the high achievers, but students whose teachers thought they weren't yet reaching their potential. The idea was to give them a glimpse of what was possible, to show them what a reach could yield. In 2012, I'd hosted students from the school at the White House during the British Prime Minister's state visit. I felt it was important to reach out to kids multiple times and in multiple ways in order for them to feel that it was all real. My early successes in life, I knew, were a product of the consistent love and high expectations with which I was surrounded as a child, both at home and at school. It was this insight that drove my White House mentoring program, and it lay at the center of a new education initiative my staff and I were now preparing to launch, called Reach Higher. I wanted to encourage kids to strive to get to college, and once there, to stick with it. I knew that in the coming years, a college education would only become more essential for young people entering a global job market. Reach Higher would seek to help them along the way, providing more support for school counselors and easier access to federal financial aid. I'd been lucky to have parents, teachers, and mentors who'd fed me with a consistent, simple message: you matter. As an adult, I wanted to pass those words to a new generation. It was the message I gave my own daughters, who were fortunate to have it reinforced daily by their school and their privileged circumstances. And I was determined to express some version of it to every young person I encountered. I wanted to be the opposite of the guidance counselor I'd had in high school, who'd blithely told me I wasn't Princeton material. "All of us believe you belong here," I'd said to the Elizabeth Garrett Anderson girls as they sat, many of them looking a little awestruck, in the Gothic Old World dining hall at Oxford, surrounded by university professors and students who'd come out for the day to mentor them. I said something similar anytime we had kids visit the White House, teens we invited from the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, children from local schools who showed up to work in the garden, high schoolers who came for our career days and workshops in fashion, music, and poetry, even kids I only got to give a quick but emphatic hug to in a rope line. The message was always the same: you belong. You matter. I think highly of you. An economist from a British university would later put out a study that looked at the test performances of Elizabeth Garrett Anderson students, finding that their overall scores jumped significantly after I'd started connecting with them, the equivalent of moving from a C average to an A. Any credit for improvement really belonged to the girls, their teachers, and the daily work they did together. But it also affirmed the idea that kids will invest more when they feel they're being invested in. I understood that there was power in showing children my regard. 2 months after Hydea Pendleton's funeral, I returned to Chicago. I directed Tina, my chief of staff, and an attorney who herself had spent many years in the city, to throw her energy into rallying support for violence prevention there. Tina was a big-hearted policy wonk with an infectious laugh and more hustle than just about anyone I knew. She understood which levers to pull inside and outside government to make an impact at the scale I envisioned. Moreover, her nature and experience wouldn't allow her voice to go unheard, especially at tables dominated by men, where she often found herself. Throughout Barack's second term, she would wrestle with the Pentagon and various state governors to clear away red tape so that veterans and military spouses could more efficiently build their careers. And she'd also help engineer a mammoth new administration-wide effort centered on girls' education worldwide. In the wake of Hydea's death, Tina had leveraged her local contacts encouraging Chicago business leaders and philanthropists to work with Mayor Rahm Emanuel to expand community programs for at-risk youth across the city. Her efforts had helped yield $33 million in pledges in just a matter of weeks. On a cool day in April, Tina and I flew out to attend a meeting of community leaders discussing youth empowerment, and also to meet a new group of kids. Earlier that winter, the public radio program This American Life had devoted 2 hours to telling the stories of students and staff from William R. Harper Senior High School in Inglewood, a neighborhood on the South Side. In the previous year, 29 of the school's current and recent students had been shot, 8 of them fatally. These numbers were astonishing to me and my staff, but the sad fact is that urban schools around the country were contending with epidemic levels of gun violence. Amid all the talk of youth empowerment, it seemed important to actually sit down and hear from the youth. When I was young, Inglewood had been a rough neighborhood, but not necessarily as deadly as it was now. In junior high, I'd traveled to Inglewood for weekly biology labs at a community college there. Now, years later, as my motorcade made its way past strips of neglected bungalows and shuttered storefronts, past vacant lots and burned-out buildings, it looked to me as if the only thriving businesses left were the liquor stores. I thought back to my own childhood and my own neighborhood and how the word ghetto got thrown around like a threat. The mere suggestion of it, I understood now, caused stable middle-class families to bail preemptively for the suburbs, worried their property values would drop. Ghetto signaled that a place was both black and hopeless. It was a label that foretold failure and then hastened its arrival. It closed corner groceries and gas stations and undermined schools and educators trying to instill self-worth in neighborhood kids. It was a word everyone tried to run from, but it could rear up on a community quick. In the middle of West Inglewood sat Harper High School, a large sand brick building with multiple wings. I met the school's principal, Leonetta Sanders, a quick-moving African-American woman who'd been at the school for 6 years, and two school social workers who immersed themselves in the lives of the 510 kids enrolled at Harper, most of them from low-income families. One of the social workers, Crystal Smith, could often be found pacing Harper's hallways between classes, peppering students with positivity, communicating her high regard for them by calling out, "I'm so proud of you," and "I see you trying hard." She'd shout, "I appreciate you in advance," for every good choice she trusted those students would make. In the school library that day, I joined a circle of 22 Harper students, all African American, mostly juniors and seniors, who were seated in chairs and on couches, dressed in khakis and collared shirts. Most were eager to talk. They described a daily, even hourly, fear of gangs and violence. Some explained that they had absent or addicted parents. A couple had spent time in juvenile detention centers. A junior named Thomas had witnessed a good friend, a 16-year-old girl, get shot and killed the previous summer. He'd also been there when his older brother, who had been partially paralyzed due to a gunshot injury, was shot and wounded in the same incident while sitting outside in his wheelchair. Nearly every kid there that day had lost someone, a friend, relative, neighbor, to a bullet. Few, meanwhile, had ever been downtown to see the lakefront or visit Navy Pier. At one point, one of the social workers interjected, saying to the group, "80 degrees and sunny." Everyone in the circle began nodding ruefully. I wasn't sure why. "Tell Mrs. Obama," she said, What goes through your mind when you wake up in the morning and hear the weather forecast is 80 and sunny? She clearly knew the answer, but wanted me to hear. A day like that, the Harper students all agreed, was no good. When the weather was nice, the gangs got more active and the shooting got worse. These kids had adapted to the upside-down logic dictated by their environment, staying indoors when the weather was good, varying the routes they took to and from school each day based on shifting gang territories and allegiances. Sometimes, they told me, taking the safest path home meant walking right down the middle of the street as cars sped past them on both sides. Doing so gave them a better view of any escalating fights or possible shooters, and it gave them more time to run. America is not a simple place. Its contradictions set me spinning. I'd found myself at Democratic fundraisers held in vast Manhattan penthouses, sipping wine with wealthy women who would claim to be passionate about education and children's issues, and then lean in conspiratorially telling me that their Wall Street husbands would never vote for anyone who even thought about raising their taxes. And now I was at Harper, listening to children talk about how to stay alive. I admired their resilience, and I wished desperately that they didn't need it so much. One of them then gave me a candid look. "It's nice that you're here and all," he said with a shrug. "But what are you actually going to do about any of this?" To them, I represented Washington, D.C. as much as I did the South Side. And when it came to Washington, I felt I owed them the truth. "Honestly," I began, "I know you're dealing with a lot here, but no one's going to save you anytime soon. Most people in Washington aren't even trying. A lot of them don't even know you exist." I explained to those students that progress is slow, that they couldn't afford to simply sit and wait for change to come. Many Americans didn't want their taxes raised, and Congress couldn't even pass a budget, let alone rise above petty partisan bickering. So there weren't going to be billion-dollar investments in education or magical turnarounds for their community. Even after the horror of Newtown, Congress appeared determined to block any measure that could help keep guns out of the wrong hands, with legislators more interested in collecting campaign donations from the National Rifle Association than they were in protecting kids. "Politics was a mess," I said. On this front, I had nothing terribly uplifting or encouraging to say. I went on, though, to make a different pitch, one that came directly from my South Side self. "Use school," I said. These kids had just spent an hour telling me stories that were tragic and unsettling, but I reminded them that those same stories also showed their persistence, self-reliance, and ability to overcome. I assured them that they already had what it would take to succeed. Here they were, sitting in a school that was offering them a free education, I said, and there were a whole lot of committed and caring adults inside that school who thought they mattered. About 6 weeks later, thanks to donations from local business people, a group of Harper students would come to the White House to visit with me and Barack personally, and also spend time at Howard University learning what college was about. I hoped they could see themselves getting there. I will never pretend that words or hugs from a first lady alone can turn somebody's life around, or that there's any easy path for students trying to navigate everything that those kids at Harper were dealing with. No story is that simple. And of course, every one of us sitting in the library that day knew this. But I was there to push back against the old and damning narrative about being a Black urban kid in America, the one that foretold failure and then hastened its arrival. If I could point out those students' strengths and give them some glimpse of a way forward, then I would always do it. It was a small difference I could make.
24. In the spring of 2015, Malia announced that she'd been invited to the prom by a boy she kind of liked. She was 16 then, finishing her junior year at Sidwell. To us, she was still our kid, long-legged and enthusiastic as she'd always been, though every day she seemed to become a little more adult. She was now nearly as tall as I was and starting to think about applying to college. She was a good student, curious and self-possessed, a collector of details, much like her dad. She'd become fascinated by films and filmmaking, and the previous summer had taken it upon herself to seek out Steven Spielberg one evening when he'd come to the White House for a dinner party, asking him so many questions that he followed up with an offer to let her intern on a TV series he was producing. Our girl was finding her way. Normally, for security reasons, Malia and Sasha weren't allowed to ride in anyone else's car. Malia had a provisional license by then and was able to drive herself around town, though always with agents following in their own vehicle. But still, since moving to Washington at the age of 10, she'd never once ridden a bus or the metro or been driven by someone who didn't work for the Secret Service. For prom night, though, we were making an exception. On the appointed evening, her date arrived in his car, clearing security at the southeast gate of the White House, following the path up and around the South Lawn by which heads of state and other visiting dignitaries normally arrived, and then gamely, bravely, walking into the dip room dressed in a black suit. "Just be cool, please, okay?" Malia had said to me and Barack, her embarrassment already beginning to smolder as we rode the elevator downstairs. I was barefoot, and Barack was in flip-flops. Malia wore a long black skirt and an elegant bare-shouldered top. She looked beautiful and about 23 years old. By my reckoning, we did manage to play it cool, though Malia still laughs, remembering it all as a bit excruciating. Barack and I shook the young man's hand, snapped a few pictures, and gave our daughter a hug before sending them on their way. We took what was perhaps unfair comfort in the knowledge that Malia's security detail would basically ride the boy's bumper all the way to the restaurant where they were going for dinner before the dance and would remain on quiet duty throughout the night. From a parent's point of view, it wasn't a bad way to raise teenagers, knowing that a set of watchful adults was trailing them at all times, tasked with extricating them from any sort of emergency. From a teenager's standpoint, though, this was understandably a complete and total drag. As with many aspects of life in the White House, we were left to sort out what it meant for our family, where and how to draw the lines, how to balance the requirements of the presidency against the needs of two kids learning how to mature on their own. Once they got to high school, we gave the girls curfews, first 11 and eventually midnight, and enforced them, according to Malia and Sasha, with more vigor than many of their friends' parents did. If I was concerned about their safety or whereabouts, I could always check in with the agents, but I tried not to. It was important to me that the kids trusted their security team. Instead, I did what I think a lot of parents do and relied on a network of other parents for information, all of us pooling what we knew about where the flock of them was going and whether there'd be an adult in charge. Of course, our girls carried extra responsibility by virtue of who their father was, knowing that their screw-ups could make headlines. Barack and I both recognized how unfair this was. Both of us had pushed boundaries and done dumb things as teenagers, and we'd been fortunate to do it all without the eyes of the nation on us. Malia had been 8 when Barack sat on the edge of her bed in Chicago and asked if she thought it was okay for him to run for president. I think now of how little she'd known at the time, how little any of us could have known. It meant one thing to be a child in the White House. It meant something different to try to emerge from it as an adult. How could Malia have guessed that she'd have men with guns following her to prom someday, or that people would take photos of her sneaking a cigarette and sell them to gossipy websites? Our kids were coming of age during what felt like a unique time. Apple had begun selling the iPhone in June 2007, about 4 months after Barack announced his candidacy for president. 1 million of them sold in less than 3 months. 1 billion of them sold before his second term was over. His was the first presidency of a new era, one involving the disruption and dismantling of all norms around privacy, involving selfies, data hacks, Snapchats, and Kardashians. Our daughters lived more deeply inside it than we did, in part because social media governed teen life, and in part because their routines put them in closer contact with the public than ours did. As Malia and Sasha moved around Washington with their friends after school or on weekends, they'd catch sight of strangers pointing their phones in their direction, or contend with grown men and women asking, even demanding, to take a selfie with them. "You do know that I'm a child, right?" Malia would sometimes say when turning someone down. Barack and I did what we could to protect our kids from too much exposure, declining all media requests for them and working to keep their everyday lives largely out of sight. Their Secret Service escorts supported us by trying to be less conspicuous when following the girls around in public, wearing board shorts and t-shirts instead of suits, and swapping their earpieces and wrist microphones for earbud sets in order to better blend in at the teenage hangouts they now frequented. We strongly disapproved of the publication of any photos of our children that weren't connected to an official event, and the White House press office made this clear to the media. Melissa and others on my team became my enforcers anytime an image of one of the girls surfaced on a gossip site, making haranguing phone calls to get it taken down. Guarding the girls' privacy meant finding other ways to satiate the public's curiosity about our family. Early in Barack's second term, we'd added a new puppy to the household, Sunny, a free-spirited rambler who seemed to see no point in being house-trained, given how big her new house was. The dogs added a lightness to everything. They were living, loafing proof that the White House was a home. Knowing that Malia and Sasha were basically off limits, the White House communications teams began requesting the dogs for official appearances. In the evenings, I'd find memos in my briefing book asking me to approve a Beau and Sunny drop-by, allowing the dogs to mingle with members of the media or children coming for a tour. The dogs would get deployed when reporters came to learn about the importance of American trade and exports, or later to hear Barack speak in favor of Merrick Garland, his pick for the Supreme Court. Beau starred in a promotional video for the Easter egg roll. He and Sunny posed with me for photos in an online campaign to urge people to sign up for healthcare coverage. They made excellent ambassadors, impervious to criticism and unaware of their own fame. Like all kids, Sasha and Malia outgrew things over time. Since the first year of Barack's presidency, they had joined him in front of reporters each fall while he performed what had to be the most ridiculous ritual of the office, pardoning a live turkey just ahead of the Thanksgiving holiday. For the first 5 years, they'd smiled and giggled as their dad cracked corny jokes. But by the sixth year, at 13 and 16, they were too old to even pretend it was funny. Within hours of the ceremony, photos of the two of them looking aggrieved appeared all over the internet. Sasha stone-faced, Malia with her arms crossed, as they stood next to the president, his lectern, and the oblivious turkey. A USA Today headline summed it up fairly enough. Malia and Sasha Obama are so done with their dad's turkey pardon. Their attendance at the pardon, as well as at virtually every White House event, became entirely optional. These were happy, well-adjusted teens with lives that were accordingly rich with activities and social intrigue, having nothing to do with their parents. As a parent, you're only sort of in control anyway. Our kids had their own agendas, which left them less impressed with even the more fun parts of ours. Do you want to come downstairs tonight and hear Paul McCartney play? Mom, please, no. There was often music blasting from Malia's room. Sasha and her friends had taken a shine to cable cooking shows and sometimes commandeered the residents' kitchen to decorate cookies or whip up elaborate multi-course meals for themselves. Both our daughters relished the relative anonymity they enjoyed when going on school trips or joining friends' families for vacations, their agents always in tow. Sasha loved nothing more than to pick out her own snacks at Dulles International Airport before boarding a packed commercial flight, for the simple fact that it was so different from the presidential rigmarole that went on at Andrews Air Force Base and had become our family's norm. Traveling with us did have its advantages. Before Barack's presidency was over, our girls would enjoy a baseball game in Havana, walk along the Great Wall of China, and visit the Christ the Redeemer statue in Rio one evening in magical, misty darkness. But it could also be a pain in the neck, especially when we were trying to tend to things unrelated to the presidency. Early in Malia's junior year, the two of us had gone to spend a day visiting colleges in New York City, for instance, setting up tours at New York University and Columbia. It had worked out fine for a while. We moved through NYU's campus at a brisk pace, our efficiency aided by the fact that it was still early and many students were not yet up for the day. We checked out classrooms, poked our heads into a dorm room, and chatted with a dean before heading uptown to grab an early lunch and move on to the next tour. The problem is that there's no hiding a first lady-sized motorcade, especially on the island of Manhattan in the middle of a weekday. By the time we finished eating, about 100 people had gathered on the sidewalk outside the restaurant, the commotion only breeding more commotion. We stepped out to find dozens of cell phones hoisted in our direction as we were engulfed by a chorus of cheers. It was beneficent, this attention. "Come to Columbia, Malia," people were shouting. But it was not especially useful for a girl who was trying quietly to imagine her own future. I knew immediately what I needed to do, and that was to bench myself, to let Malia go see the next campus without me, sending Kristen Jones, my personal assistant, as her escort instead. Without me there, Malia's odds of being recognized went down. She could move faster and with a lot fewer agents. Without me, she could maybe, possibly, look like just another kid walking the quad. I at least owed her a shot at that. Kristen, in her late 20s and a California native, was like a big sister to both my girls anyway. She'd come to my office as a young intern, and along with Kristen Jarvis, who until recently had been my trip director, was instrumental in our family's life, filling some of these strange gaps caused by the intensity of our schedules and the hindering nature of our fame. The Christens, as we called them, stood in for us often. They served as liaisons between our family and Sidwell, setting up meetings and interacting with teachers, coaches, and other parents when Barack and I weren't able. With the girls, they were protective, loving, and far hipper than I'd ever be in the eyes of my kids. Malia and Sasha trusted them implicitly, seeking their counsel on everything from wardrobe and social media to the increasing proximity of boys. While Malia toured Columbia that afternoon, I was put into a secure holding area designated by the Secret Service, what turned out to be the basement of an academic building on campus, where I sat alone and unnoticed until it was time to leave, wishing I'd at least brought a book to read. It hurt a little to be down there, I'll admit. I felt a kind of loneliness that probably had less to do with the fact that I was by myself killing time in a windowless room, and more to do with the idea that, like it or not, the future was coming, that our first baby was going to grow up and leave. We weren't at the end yet, but already I was beginning to take stock. I found myself tallying the gains and losses, what had been sacrificed and what we could count as progress, in our country, in our family. Had we done all we could? Were we going to come out of this intact? I tried to think back and remember how it was that my life had forked away from the predictable control freak fantasy existence I'd envisioned for myself, the one with the steady salary, a house to live in forever, a routine to my days. At what point had I chosen away from that? When had I allowed the chaos inside? Had it been on the summer night when I lowered my ice cream cone and leaned in to kiss Barack for the first time? Was it the day I'd finally walked away from my orderly piles of documents and my partner-track career in law, convinced I'd find something more fulfilling? My mind sometimes landed back in the church basement in Roseland on the far south side of Chicago, where I'd gone 25 years earlier to be with Barack as he spoke to a neighborhood group that was struggling to push back against hopelessness and indifference. Listening to the conversation that evening, I'd heard something familiar articulated in a new way. It was possible, I knew, to live on two planes at once, to have one's feet planted in reality, but pointed in the direction of progress. It was what I'd done as a kid on Euclid Avenue, what my family and marginalized people more generally had always done. You got somewhere by building that better reality, if at first only in your mind. Or as Barack put it that night, you may live in the world as it is, but you can still work to create the world as it should be. I'd known the guy for only a couple of months then, but in retrospect, I see now that this was my swerve. In that moment, without saying a word, I'd signed on for a lifetime of us and a lifetime of this. All these years later, I was thankful for the progress I saw. In 2015, I was still making visits to Walter Reed, but each time it seemed there were fewer wounded warriors to visit. The United States had fewer service members at risk overseas, fewer injuries needing care, fewer mothers with their hearts broken. This, to me, was progress. Progress was the Centers for Disease Control reporting that childhood obesity rates appeared to be leveling off, particularly among children ages 2 to 5. It was 2,000 high school students in Detroit showing up to help me celebrate College Signing Day, a holiday we'd helped expand as part of Reach Higher to mark the day when young people committed to their colleges. Progress was the Supreme Court's decision to reject a challenge to a key part of the country's new health care law, all but ensuring that Barack's signature domestic achievement, the security of health insurance for every American, would remain strong and intact once he left office. It was an economy that had been hemorrhaging 800,000 jobs a month when Barack entered the White House, having now racked up nearly 5 straight years of continuous job growth. I took this all in as evidence that as a country, we were capable of building a better reality. But still, we lived in the world as it is. A year and a half after Newtown, Congress had passed not a single gun control measure. Bin Laden was gone, but ISIS had arrived. The homicide rate in Chicago was going up rather than down. A black teen named Michael Brown was shot by a cop in Ferguson, Missouri. His body left in the middle of the road for hours. A black teen named Laquan McDonald was shot 16 times by police in Chicago, including 9 times in the back. A black boy named Tamir Rice was shot dead by police in Cleveland while playing with a toy gun. A black man named Freddie Gray died after being neglected in police custody in Baltimore. A black man named Eric Garner was killed by police after being put in a chokehold during his arrest on Staten Island. All this was evidence of something pernicious and unchanging in America. When Barack was first elected, various commentators had naively declared that our country was entering a post-racial era in which skin color would no longer matter. Here was proof of how wrong they'd been. As Americans obsessed over the threat of terrorism, many were overlooking the racism and tribalism that were tearing our nation apart. Late in June 2015, Barack and I flew to Charleston, South Carolina, to sit with another grieving community, this time at the funeral of a pastor named Clementa Pinckney, who had been one of 9 people killed in a racially motivated shooting earlier in the month at an African Methodist Episcopal church known simply as Mother Emanuel. The victims, all African Americans, had welcomed an unemployed 21-year-old white man, a stranger to them all, into their Bible study group. He'd sat with them for a while. Then, after the group bowed their heads in prayer, he stood up and began shooting. In the middle of it, he was reported to have said, "I have to do this because you rape our women and you're taking over our country." After delivering a moving eulogy for Reverend Pinckney and acknowledging the deep tragedy of the moment, Barack surprised everyone by leading the congregation in a slow and soulful rendition of Amazing Grace. It was a simple invocation of hope, a call to persist. Everyone in the room, it seemed, joined in. For more than 6 years now, Barack and I lived with an awareness that we ourselves were a provocation. As minorities across the country were gradually beginning to take on more significant roles in politics, business, and entertainment, our family had become the most prominent example. Our presence in the White House had been celebrated by millions of Americans, but it also contributed to a reactionary sense of fear and resentment among others. The hatred was old and deep, and as dangerous as ever. We lived with it as a family, and we lived with it as a nation, and we carried on as gracefully as we could. The same day as the funeral service in Charleston, June 26, 2015, the Supreme Court of the United States issued a landmark decision affirming that same-sex couples had the right to marry in all 50 states. This was the culmination of a legal battle that had been fought methodically over decades, state by state, court by court, and as with any civil rights struggle, it had required the persistence and courage of many people. On and off over the course of the day, I'd caught reports of Americans overjoyed by the news. A jubilant crowd chanted, "Love has won," on the steps of the Supreme Court. Couples were flocking to city halls and county courthouses to exercise what was now a constitutional right. Gay bars were opening early. Rainbow flags waved on street corners around the country. All this had helped buoy us through a sad day in South Carolina. Returning home to the White House, we changed out of our funeral clothes, had a quick dinner with the girls, and then Barack had disappeared into the treaty room to flip on ESPN and catch up on work. I was heading to my dressing room when I caught sight of a purplish glow through one of the north-facing windows of the residence, at which point I remembered that our staff had planned to illuminate the White House in the rainbow colors of the pride flag. Looking out the window, I saw that beyond the gates on Pennsylvania Avenue, a big crowd of people had gathered in the summer dusk to see the lights. The North Drive was filled with government staff who'd stayed late to see the White House transformed in celebration of marriage equality. The decision had touched so many people. From where I stood, I could see the exuberance, but I could hear nothing. It was an odd part of our reality. The White House was a silent, sealed fortress, almost all sound blocked by the thickness of its windows and walls. The Marine One helicopter could land on one side of the house, its rotor blades kicking up gale-force winds and slamming tree branches. But inside the residence, we'd hear nothing. I usually figured out that Barack had arrived home from a trip not by the sound of his helicopter, but rather by the smell of its fuel, which somehow managed to permeate. Oftentimes, I was happy to withdraw into the protected hush of the residence at the end of a long day, but this night felt different, as paradoxical as the country itself. After a day spent grieving in Charleston, I was looking at a giant party starting just outside my window. Hundreds of people were staring up at our house. I wanted to see it the way they did. I found myself suddenly desperate to join the celebration. I stuck my head into the treaty room. "You want to go out and look at the lights?" I asked Barack. "There are tons of people out there." He laughed. "You know I can't do tons of people." Sasha was in her room engrossed in her iPad. "You want to go see the rainbow lights with me?" I asked. "Nope." This left Malia, who surprised me a little by immediately signing on. I'd found my wingwoman. We were going on an adventure, outside, where people were gathered, and we weren't going to ask anyone's permission. The normal protocol was that we checked in with the Secret Service agents posted by the elevator any time we wanted to leave the residence, whether it was going to go downstairs to watch a movie or take the dogs out for a walk. But not tonight. Malia and I just busted past the agents on duty, neither one of us making eye contact. We bypassed the elevator, moving quickly down a cramped stairwell. I could hear dress shoes clicking down the stairs behind us, the agents trying to keep up. Malia gave me a devilish smirk. She wasn't used to my flouting the rules. Reaching the state floor, we made our way toward the tall set of doors leading to the north portico when we heard a voice. "Hello, ma'am. Can I help you?" It was Claire Faulkner, the usher on night duty. She was a friendly, soft-spoken brunette who I assumed had been tipped off by the agents whispering into their wrist pieces behind us. I looked over my shoulder at her without breaking my stride. "Oh, we're just going outside," I said.